Constantino est professeur à l'École française d'Extrême-Orient sur un poste créé par la Robert O. Family Foundation. C'est un spécialiste de la littérature bouddhique chinoise et notamment des manuscrits de Dunhuang bouddhiste ainsi que de l'iconographie bouddhique de Dunhuang. Il a publié il y a 3 ans un premier ouvrage consacré à un apocryphe bouddhique du 5e siècle. Il est en train de préparer une traduction d'un traité du Weishu consacré au bouddhisme et au taoïsme. Et il a collaboré de manière extrêmement extensive avec, d'une part, Kuo Liying, qui se trouve ici, et avec Jean-Pierre Drèche, ses deux directeurs de thèse. Et avec Jean-Pierre Drèche, notamment, il a copublié la fabrique du lisible, à laquelle il a donné de nombreuses notices. Je lui laisse la parole.
Merci Étienne pour cette présentation. Merci beaucoup aux organisateurs d'abord d'avoir organisé cette très belle conférence qui nous permet de nous rencontrer ici. Je passe en anglais.
So today we'll be talking about mistakes and misinterpretations in the transmission of Buddhist texts, and more specifically about the process of textual corruption in Chinese medieval manuscripts with a focus on Dunhuang material. So as all you know, the introduction and spread of Buddhism in China was carried out by way of these extensive translation activities, and the translation of Buddhist scriptures into Chinese was closely linked with the criteria for distinguishing canonical scriptures from apocrypha, and this implied as a basic condition the existence of an original Indian scriptures available to the translators. And such original scriptures could be contained in a manuscript that a Chinese pilgrim may have brought from outside China, and scriptures were also transmitted orally by foreign masters either lived in China or in bordering regions or traveled throughout the country to spread the Dharma, as you know. So in the first case, the translation was based on a scripture written on a given material support, which may already have included various codicological elements and devices. And in the second case, the translators had to work with a text recited by heart, a text which had to be translated into Chinese first and then adapted to a specific material support. And of course, needless to say, the translation process itself was quite complex. It was the result of collaborative work carried out by a team, including scribes, individuals in charge of verifying the translations, proofreaders, professionals who assemble the manuscripts, etc., etc. And many mistakes could arise during this phase of translation, and we may get an idea of the amount of inconsistency in rendering various notions only when, for example, an Indian version of a given text is available. And even in this case, we can only make conjectures because we don't have the same text that the translator had. Or we may get an idea of this phenomenon if we can compare two or more translations of the same text. Or finally, we can get, let's say, empirical evidence when the textual context suggests contradictions. For example, if the doctrinal context would seem to make reference to a specific notion and we would expect a specific term, such as, let's say, samskara, to provide a famous example highlighted by Karashima. But in Chinese, we have shensu, which is typically used to translate samsara. Even if we are not familiar with Sanskrit or Middle Indic, we may suppose that there was a mix-up at a certain point in the translation process, or maybe there is another explanation. So, apart from the problem of translating complex notions, this process could also at times give rise to textual elements such as short commentaries, glosses, and notes that then became part of the text itself. For example, short notes based on oral explanations given during the translation process were sometimes accidentally integrated into the text, and also due to the specific layout of Chinese exegetical literature. And here I quote de Mieville on this topic. And at a different level, scribal errors and misinterpretations of various kinds could also arise during the production of a manuscript or during the copying and transmission of a scriptures. And these elements could affect the text layout, the material support, and could also have an effect on the meaning of the source text. So today I will offer a few points regarding various mistakes, alterations, and corrections of this type, which provide us a better understanding of some aspects of scriptural transmission. So to begin with, we should note that the question of scribal errors in medieval manuscripts from a codicological point of view has mainly been studied to explore the scribal practices employed to rectify or highlight mistakes made during the copying or the assembling of a manuscript. And surprisingly, there are only a few Western scholars who have treated this topic for medieval China, in particular Jean-Pierre Drege and Olivier Venture in Paris. And then we have Imre Golambos in Cambridge. But apart from the techniques for correcting scribal mistakes, what is interesting are also the mechanisms related to the production of mistakes in Buddhist scriptures. Mechanisms that provide us information about the specific features of the source text, of the source manuscript, and about the dynamics of the copying process. And generally speaking, one could distinguish between, let's say, unintentional mistakes linked to distraction, for example, the text is very long and complex, or the tools for writing are unsuitable, as stated in this famous and funny writing exercise. And then we have, let's say, intentional mistakes linked to misinterpretations of the text that leads the scribe to modify the text. And then we have a third type, mistakes linked to misinterpretation of the text layout, of the text architecture. And you will see that this category also provides us information on the scribes who worked in or for Buddhist monasteries in medieval China. So what about the mechanisms linked to the production of these unintentional mistakes? What can we learn from them? So to begin with the most simple point, the first question we might ask ourselves when we examine a manuscript is if that manuscript or a given manuscript was copied by dictation or from a source manuscript that the scribe had in front of him. So it goes without saying that specific mistakes provide us with information specifically about copying techniques. And we can come across mistakes linked to hearing, which can help us to make hypotheses about an oral transmission of a text via dictation, for example. And they are particularly significant in Chinese due to the great number of homophones. Here you have an example. The scribe has written show instead of show, and has provided immediately a correction. Examples of this kind may not be very convincing, as I believe they are most likely linked to memory and not to an oral transmission. But we know, for example, that between 855 and 860, the Buddhist master Fachen, or Chosgrub in Tibetan, gave various sermons on the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra in the Dunhuang region. And his comments were recorded by his disciples, who wrote notes on the basis of his oral presentation. So this suggests a process quite different from dictation, but in any case, let's say an oral form of transmission, and precisely we find various mistakes linked to homophony, as you can see in the examples I highlighted here. On the other hand, errors linked to sight would seem to be linked to written transmissions. And there are various examples of mistakes. One of them is the accidental act of repeating a character or a sentence due to a similar text block found in a juxtaposed section of the text. And this is quite frequent in Buddhist scriptures, which, as you know, contain lots of very similar text blocks or sentences repeated over and over, here described as written subhuti, and then had to write ruo pusa, but then it was influenced by this one, and so he wrote ruo puti, and then the wrong characters were colored out, and there was this correction. And a similar thing in this example, you have two very similar sentences, gu shen huan si xing nian zhu, and then here you have the word pusa, bodhisattva, identical sentence in the second column, but then here you had Rulai, Tathagata, but probably the scribe had written Pusa in this place, and then these two characters were scratched out and rewritten to correct this mistake. And then we have repetition, that is to say, when two lines of a sentence which end with the same characters are accidentally repeated, similar to what happens in the case of Omiyo Tuluten. This is a very simple example. This line ends with Qing, and this one with the same characters. So the scribe has mistakenly copied these two columns two times, because they ended with the same character. And another example are anticipation of characters or of sentences due to the fact that the scribe has skipped a part of the text containing the same words or similar sentences. The scribe has mistakenly copied the second column before the first one. You see these columns are almost identical, and so the scribe most likely has copied the second one before the first one, but then he just figured out his mistake, and so he scratched out the wrong characters, which were subsequently rewritten. And errors can be linked also to archaic writing style in the source text or obsolete taboo characters. That is to say, all these characters which had to be avoided because they were part of the family name of the ruling family, and in a changed historical context, they were no longer in use, and at times they were copied by a scribe who was unaware of their exact meaning. And this precisely constituted a mistake in a new historical context. A slightly different category of mistakes is that of copying mistakes linked to memory. When the scribe reads a long sentence and starts to write it, but at a certain point he makes mistakes because he transposes in the text words that are familiar to him. Here I have an example. He had to write huaxiang, but huaxiang is quite a weird word, not very frequent. So he wrote huafuo, a transformation Buddha, which is much more common in Buddhist scriptures. And the mistakes we come across in a manuscript can help us to determine if a given manuscript has the same format as the source manuscript. And we have at least two instances. The scribe has skipped a section of the text which was found between two columns ending with the same characters. And this is evident, for example, when the scribe has subsequently provided a correction. What happened here? This sentence ended with these three characters, and the second one ended also with these three characters, so it was skipped because the scribe thought he already had copied it. But thanks to this mistake, we know that the source manuscript was a scroll and had the same layout, that is to say 17 characters column, which is the standard for manuscripts intended for a monastic libraries. Same phenomenon here, but this is not a scroll, it is a codex. And in this specific case, same phenomenon, this sentence ends with these four characters as this one, and the scribe has skipped two columns. So we know the characteristics of the source manuscript. And Similarly, inaccuracy in filling the columns with characters can inform us as to the intention of making an identical copy of the original by inserting the same number of characters. And this is evident when the available space and the size of the characters was calculated incorrectly. And either there is too much blank space at the end of the column, or the last character is written below the bottom margin. What you have in these two cases is a clumsy attempt to making an identical copy of the source manuscript. Some types of errors that led the scribe to leave his work unfinished show scribal practices involving various phases in the copying process. And this working method is often found in manuscripts composed of heterogeneous elements such as text and images, or diverse textual elements such as prose and verses, prose and dharanis, etc. Not really an expert in distinguishing between the various handwriting styles appearing in the same manuscript, but in such cases, one might wonder whether there was a scribe specialized in copying specific part of the text, or if this method was employed for other reasons. This is a copy of the Wuliang Shoujing, which alternates dharanis and, let's say, prose. And thanks to this example, in which the scribe has stopped writing, most likely because there was a mistake, a phonetic mistake, at the beginning of the last dharani. But thanks to this, we know that the dharanis were written in a second phase. Example number two. This example shows that the manuscript was copied at least in three phases. This is a copy of the Foming Jing, in which a great number of Buddha's names are listed and preceded by the word Namo. And thanks to the manuscript on the left, we know how was produced most likely the manuscript on the right. That is to say, in three phases. First, Namo, then these illustrations, and then all the Buddha's name. And the second type of mistakes are linked to misinterpretation of the text. This specific topic is more closely linked to the domain of philology. So there are quite precise mechanisms that are linked to the spread of this typology of mistakes, which are in fact wrong corrections. And the most common example is when a scribe acts like an exegete and simplifies a text on the basis of what he thinks is correct, replacing, for example, unusual words with more familiar ones, or making a sentence less controversial. That is to say that he replaces a complex original reading by a simpler reading, or by a more common, let's say, lectio, and therefore there is a phenomenon of simplification. Here I'm cheating a little bit with this example, which is taken from the text I've been working on for a little while, the Jintu Sammeijin. In this commentary, which quotes from the Jintu Sammeijin, the title Jintu, which means pure salvation, is corrected with something more less weird, that is to say, pure land, which sounded much better, even if it's wrong. And I will not go into much detail concerning these types of mistakes. I should only note that there is a general tendency to confuse the notion of mistakes with that of textual variant. And if we compare several manuscripts containing the same text, we may realize that the number of variants are in fact mistakes. And this is particularly true if we work with the printed edition of the canon, where we have all these beautiful footnotes. Here you have an example, footnotes number 8. It's telling you that sh, which means a word, etc. In the three editions, you have a variant, sang sh. So you may think, okay, this is an interesting variant. But if you are familiar with handwriting and manuscripts, you know that the sang shi usually is written in this form, which is highly reminiscent to the character shi. So this is not a variant. This is a mistake. And in the field of manuscript studies, the notion of mistakes or scriptural alterations somehow goes beyond goes beyond the notion of mistakes in the context of Buddhist philology, where this term is applied only to the core elements of the manuscript, that is to say, the text. In the domain of codicology, on the other hand, these notions involve the idea of manuscripts seen as objects and provided by a specific structure, a layout, etc. So due to this, I personally like to define a mistake or an alteration as an element that deforms the source manuscript, either by altering its original content or by modifying its layout. And formal characteristics so has to affect the meaning of the original text. So another level of misunderstanding involves the layout of the text or the codicological unit. And this happens if a scribe either introduces paratextual elements which modify, maybe incorrectly, the meaning of the source text, or if a scribe omits paratextual elements which are fundamental to the understanding of the text, thereby changing the original meaning. And now I will go into more detail, providing one example involving a misunderstanding of the layout of the source manuscript, and which is in fact a paper that I recently submitted for publication. So this is the example is found in this manuscript Pelio 2824, which contains a beautiful and complex cosmological chart and is certainly one of the most fascinating documents among the Dunhuang manuscripts of the French collection. As you can see here, there is a captivating combination of iconography and text in this vertical scroll entitled Chart of the Three Realms and the Nine Lands, which displays a schematic representation of Buddhist cosmology, a representation which is linked to specific scriptural sources, in particular the Chinese translation of the Abhidharma Kosha by Xuanzang or Juche Lun. In a recent paper, my colleague Françoise Bontoutin has analyzed each component of this chart, providing a detailed analysis of this of the cosmological aspects of this scroll. So I will not go into further detail concerning these aspects. What I will focus on is an incomprehensible text which results from a mistake in the interpretation of the layout of the source manuscript. And in this chart, there are various types of inscriptions that Professor Wang Tutan has categorized in three types. The first one, descriptive types, title-like inscriptions giving the general name of the cosmological element. And then you have explanatory type, more extensive inscriptions giving a few details on the elements they explain, and then inscriptions relating to religious practice, which focus more specifically on meditation, on the different phases of the spiritual path leading to the destruction of the defilements which make an obstacle to the achievement of the awakening. And the short text I want to show you is in the lower part of the scroll, where the three bad destinies of animals, hungry ghosts, and the hells are depicted in one architectural structure, which is highly reminiscent of a Chinese fortress. And even at first glance, the interpretation of this text is problematic. I display here the text in English translation to give you a better idea. For example, the text starts with a sentence concerning hell number 8 in the standard hot hell system, and then continues with the 7th, and then the 4th, and then the 5th, the 6th, and then the 1st. So the text just doesn't make sense. And a Chinese scholar, Hu Tongqing, in a 1996 paper has highlighted that certain sentences follow naturally from the preceding ones, while others were most likely written in the wrong direction. However, he was unable to explain the precise reasons for this mistake and how the sentences were mixed up. Françoise Bontoutin has not addressed this point because it was not really the goal of her paper, and she just quoted Hu and noted that the sentences are arranged in a chaotic way. So before going any further, I should point out that the scroll's general layout is quite particular, as part of the text are arranged in a mirror image, that is to say, the texts directly to the left of the pagoda are written from right to left in the usual direction, and those on the right side from left to right. So in this example, left to right writing is used only on the right side of the manuscript and with the main goal of giving the impression of a symmetrical structure. Anyway, one would first suppose that this text concerning the hells should be read in one direction or in the other to be understood. However, if you try to do that, you will see that it just doesn't work. And the general layout, the general appearance of its layout with the last column terminated before the end of the available space suggests that the text was intended to be read from right to left. A closer look to this text shows that it is in fact made of coherent sentences which would seem to be arranged in a confusing manner. So the first step is to identify the sentences that make sense, and Hu Tongqing has highlighted that by arranging them in a different way, it is possible to obtain three text blocks. The first makes reference to Avicii Hell, quoting the Zhishe Lun, and gives some details on its size and makes brief reference to the 16 secondary hells. The second one makes reference to eight hells which are referred to as cold hells in various sources, and the last one makes reference to the eight major hot hells, again with some details on the sinner's lifespan. Our present task is to imagine how the text layout of the source manuscript may have been and how the scribe could have deviated so far from it as to produce such an incomprehensible inscription. So the first line is here, the second one is here, the third line is here, etc., etc. So it is quite confusing. So the crucial point is how were the sentences mixed up? And the answer is point number one, most likely the scribe has mistakenly copied from right to left a text which was originally written from left to right. And point number two, we can imagine that the scribe did not reproduce the same layout and column breaks as the source manuscript he had in front of him because he had a different material support and had to arrange this text in a different page layout. So to reconstruct the hypothetical layout of the source text, I carried out various philological experiments, and at a certain point I worked from right to left and tried to make column breaks each time a sentence did not follow onto the next in terms of coherence. And in this way, I obtain, I believe, what I believe is the hypothetical layout of the text in the source manuscript, this one. So I imagine that the scribe copied this text in a continuous flow from right to left and then created new column breaks where necessary to adapt the text of the source manuscript in the space available to him in the Palio manuscript. And if we copy the source text from right to left and try to make it fit in the space available in the Palio manuscript, we obtain precisely the same confusing sentence order, as you can see here. This is the source manuscript. I start to copy from the wrong direction, but then I still have some space, so I continue. And then here I still have some space, so I continue. And then, like this, until the end, and the what I get is this incomprehensible inscription. And so when I first read this text, my first hypothesis was that this reverse copying was caused by the confusion due to the diverse scribal practices. I thought it was a consequence of the heterogeneous nature of book production in the 9th and 10th century, which witnessed the coexistence of various material supports, languages, manuscript cultures, and scribal practices in Dunhuang, as you know, in particular Tibetan and Chinese. However, after this trial, I am more inclined to believe that the mistake was produced by a misunderstanding of the general layout of the source manuscript. So, in conclusion, apart from the important role of entertaining people like me with this sort of enigma, what can we learn from this mistake? This phenomenon shows that the scribes involved in the production of Buddhist documents were most likely, at least in certain cases, not familiar with the material they were copying. And we might wonder if the copyist had any idea of what he was writing in this specific case. And this is comparable to the specific context in which anyone familiar with the Latin alphabet can make a perfect copy of a Latin text without understanding a single word. And so to switch to a general conclusion, in light of all these examples, at least from medieval China, I believe that the analysis of the mechanisms associated with the occurrence of scribal errors and subsequent corrections and their value as tools to get information regarding textual transmission, copying processes, and the various phases of manuscript production is an element which would probably warrant further research. And that's all I have for you today. Thanks for your attention.